right, welcome everyone to Talking Shop Down Under. This is your host, Richard Banks, and I'm sitting here live at Yow, Melbourne, Yow. And I'm talking to Patrick Cooney. You can say hello at this point.
Hello.
And Joel Pobar, who needs lots of introduction because no one's ever heard of this guy.
Hello.
That's the same voice. All right, so guys, we've just stepped out of your session. You've just delivered your session. Do you want to just introduce yourself and give us a quick run through of what the session was about?
Sure. I'm Patrick Cooney, and I'm a programmer. I've spent a bit of time doing different things over the years. I was a programmer in Microsoft in Redmond for a while. Done a lot of online stuff, and now I'm doing financial trading systems.
So, what were you doing in Redmond?
What was I doing in Redmond? That's the question I ask myself all the time. Yeah. So I worked in the Visual Studio team, and I worked on some bits of Visual Studio that no one ever used to do with modeling and designers and this sort of thing.
Oh, the modeling parts.
Yeah, the modeling parts.
So Visual Studio Architects Edition.
Yeah, that and related things, yeah.
I actually ran into someone who bought Architect Edition.
They probably asked for their money back.
As a developer.
Yeah. They bought it by accident, I guess. Yeah.
And hello, Microsoft. We love you. All right, and Joel.
So I've been on the show before. Big fan, Richard. So at the moment, I used to work in the same investment bank as Patrick. And I've since finished that gig. They've deployed into kind of various stock exchanges around the world, Asia and Australasia and so on. So now I'm kind of just a freelancer, work for hire type guy. And currently I'm working in Brisbane with the Microsoft SDC guys.
Excellent. So you're both looking for work soon, right?
I'm
mucking around.
Actually,
you may not be too
far from the truth on Patrick's side. I don't know if you've seen the market lately, but it's pretty shocking.
Well, apparently the Visual Studio team's hiring. You could always, if you haven't burnt your bridges now, which you probably just have, you could always get back there. All right, so the talk you guys gave was on concurrency, performance, and things like that. So normally when we talk about performance, we're talking about things like, you know, latency and web applications and with most people doing web work, we're talking, you know, how do I minimize network traffic and database calls and that sort of thing, because that's where we get a lot of performance gains. But you were taking a kind of a different view.
So I think we went a little deeper, and it wasn't for everyone. A lot deeper. So it's not for everyone, but hopefully the learnings from going deep can be used in your kind of normal day job. So when we built a high-frequency trading platform,
which means what, by the way? So high frequency, we're talking about thousands of transactions, or
it means a whole different, it's a whole different slew of things depending on which context and which market. But at least in Australia, it means that you're getting potentially thousands, maybe tens of thousands messages coming off the wire from the stock exchange,
mm-hmm.
and your goal is to take those messages and do something to them, usually price them into derivatives,
okay,
and then supply the market with those prices. That's kind of what we were doing. Patrick was doing something a little bit different, similar idea.
Yep.
So that's kind of high frequency trading. It's got a lot of stuff in the press at the moment, particularly in New York. There's big investment banks doing some pretty crazy stuff. They need to take all these quotes off the wire and get them priced and make trades within kind of microseconds.
So the intent is all the financial organizations around the world are basically trying to pull this information in as fast as they can, figure out if it hits their particular maximized profit calculation,
yep,
and then grab that transaction as fast as they can in return and snipe everyone else. So it's basically eBay sniping game.
Oh yeah, that's pretty good representation of exactly what they're doing. They're trying to snipe
because that. Greed is good, right?
Well, yeah, you watch Wall Street.
Hang on.
Talking about market inefficiency here.
So anyway, back to the presentation was basically our journey doing those frameworks, For us, we needed to deeply understand concurrency and exploit concurrency in a kind of, you know, like, I mean, we've seen hardware trend lately. It's more hardware threads. So we need to exploit that. So half the talk was talking about how to exploit that hardware-based concurrency. And the other half of the talk was something that most devs don't really think about too much, and that is, how do you exploit the memory subsystem to go faster and faster?
Yeah, so that I found that really interesting, actually. So one of the things that we normally think about with .NET is basically our method calls and whether we're calling too many methods and what we're doing with our stack and all that sort of stuff. But the first thing you threw up on screen was CPU architectures and a 486 execution pipeline and L1, L2 caches, and we're talking nanosecond type stuff here.
Yep.
So what the?
Yeah. So I think the core point out of those set of slides was how much latency is there between an instruction on the CPU saying, I need this memory address. And it turns out that between the CPU and the RAM subsystem, there can be quite a lot of latency, relatively. So if you're talking to just the CPU caches, so you ask for a memory address that happens to be in a processor's cache, then the latency is quite small. So L1 is about kind of, I don't know, 3 nanoseconds. L2, which is the next cache level up, that was about 8 to 10 nanoseconds, give or take. But going to RAM, it all of a sudden gets pretty expensive relative to the caches. So going to RAM costs us about 80 nanoseconds. So that's an order of magnitude difference. There's massive asymmetry in the latencies between that. So the core point is, why not exploit that? Why not try and get our data structures in cache so that we can get much quicker?
Yeah, I just add to that. I think they're talking about really small numbers, but they add up. So you might be talking about a number of nanoseconds to access memory, but programs access a lot of memory. So you're rather than looking about it as a small number, you could look at it as a big multiplier. So it's, you know, twice or 10 times or 50 times more expensive to access memory in this place versus another. And that's basically a tax your application is paying. So it pays to be aware of it.
Well, so for trading or anything where you're doing massive volumes, though, if you're taking, 10 times longer to process something, then that makes a big difference, I suppose. It's not something I suppose that many people really think about, because in .NET, what are we worried about? You know, GC collections and things like that, and you know, the fact that we're in managed languages, that sort of nanosecond performance, most people would cry. The first thing you do is you just go straight to C++, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of systems are actually built in C or C++, and a lot of systems, it really depends on the market, but for some markets, things are running on FPGAs. They're not even running on machines.
What?
Field programmable gate arrays. So you actually you actually don't run on an operating system. You run on a little programmable piece of hardware, because even the operating cost is too high. And you know, .NET can't compete with that. And won't compete with that. It really depends on the market, and you're always balancing time to market and availability of people who can actually program this stuff, and all these things are in the mix, and certainly for some markets you probably couldn't do you use the sort of technologies we're using to do the sort of things we're doing, but in some markets you can.
But it doesn't just have to be financial transactions. It can be just a high volume retail site. You know, you're just trying to turn things over. So you talked about Google found in terms of traffic results and I think it was.
For every 500, so Amazon was a good example. So for every 100 milliseconds of latency that Amazon were taking to generate their page, cost them about 1% in sales. So 100 ms isn't very much, 1/10 of a second. But it made a huge difference to their bottom line. But I think it's important to put this in context. Like the financial world is just, it's a nice story. It's a nice narrative, right?
Yep.
For a .NET programmer, you think, oh, okay, yeah, these guys are doing some crazy high frequency stuff and they needed to know about caches and concurrency. Okay, fine. But the takeaway, I think, is we should, as developers, know about this stuff so that we understand the general rules and apply them in our day job. And one of the general rules we talked about was make sure your data structures are small and tight, because if they are, they're going to perform better on any CPU. And so if a programmer knows that and knows why, then we have a win.
So small and tight means what in particular? So are there guidelines you guys tried to stick to, you know, less than 10 properties or fields, that sort of thing? Or
so I'll even go even easier than that. If you're like a good .NET application size is around 50 megabytes. If you're anything above that, then
in terms of size of program, or in terms of working set.
Yep, the working set of like the private bytes of an application.
Yep,
you want to get as low as you possibly can, but the smaller the better. But yeah, and if you're over 50 meg, then it's kind of
so that breaks most Twitter clients.
Yes. You know, so as a good general rule of thumb, like it just means thinking about the framework APIs you're using. So a good example is XML. Probably not a great API to be using if you care about working set.
Because of the bloat.
Because it brings in a ton of stuff that you may end up not even needing. Like if you don't need XML, why not look at CSV or some sort of binary format or whatever?
Yep.
And also what the XML APIs do under the covers. Quite often when you ask an XML API, hey, I need to read this XML file, they'll load up the entire XML file in memory. That's not great. That's not great for working set, and it's not great for laying this stuff out on cache. So it's things like that. Just be aware of it.
So string manipulation as well, obviously the way .NET does things with strings affects GC and memory allocation and so forth. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, so strings are immutable, so if you manipulate them, then you're getting a brand new copy of whatever the manipulation is. So from that perspective, then if you're doing a lot of string manipulation, then it's going to cost you. But if you're using a lot of strings and you're not manipulating them too much, then okay, you're just going to have to pay the cost of the string. What else can I say about that?
But you talked also about reusing objects, or, you know, if an object you're about to get rid of, one of the tricks you can do to avoid it getting GC'd is actually to repurpose it, I suppose, or just refresh the contents of it and then reuse that.
Yeah, that's definitely a technique. It can feel a little dirty, but if you've got some code that's running in a tight loop, or is called very, very frequently, not newing up an object every time can be a big win, because you're not going to have nearly as much GC going on. So, you know, a great example of this is if you're doing serialization, just reusing the buffer you're serializing in, which isn't a huge, you know, it's not a huge leap to make, can make a big difference, because you're going to have, you know, potentially, you know, a K or a couple of K of buffer there, things like that.
So, that K or that, you know, 2K or whatever it's going to be, where does that sit? Because you talk, you know, again, that's going to come into CPU cache and then wherever and wherever and wherever. Do things always turn up in a certain spot, or how's the CPU move things around? How's it affect performance? You don't know memory. Am I asking a bad question? Quite possibly. I'm getting a blank look. So,
you're saying, you know, if you've got a K, you've got a buffer.
The caching that happens in the CPU. Yeah. So there's the L1, L2, L3 business. That 1K is going to sit inside.
Yeah, so it's going to be in memory. It's going to be in you know, one or more of the caches. So you've got your lower level cache, like say your L3 cache. And then if it's in L3, it could potentially be in L2, and then potentially in L1. Actually, that's a little dependent on the CPU you're on, but on an Intel CPU, that would be true. You've basically got, you know, if you've used that byte array recently, it's much more likely to be in those caches and therefore be efficient to use and quick to use.
Okay, and if we're dealing with threading though, that can change things, right? So if we're running this loop in a multi-threaded situation, there's thread contention that you talked about.
Yeah, sure. So threads run on CPU cores, obviously, and these caches are tied to CPU cores. So if you've got two threads that are running on different cores, they're less likely to share those caches. So for example, on an Intel i7, the L1 and L2 cache are per core, and the L3 is basically per socket, so it's shared across the cores. So if you've got two threads running on the same socket, they'll share the L3, but not the L1 and L2. If the same socket, different cores.
Yep.
So again, you know, the multi-threading is great, but there is sort of a hidden cost there in the sense that your memory accesses are going to be cheaper from one core than another, potentially.
And there's ways to find that. Like, how do you find these things? There's, you know, you jump in, you run your code and you run it and you go, okay, it's performing a bit slow, but, you know, what do we normally do? We normally run the thing. We do instrumentation on our code. We use the profiling tools. We see certain method calls get called and we go, okay, so it's going to be, let's stop calling that method so many times. But we get to a point where we have to call the method and then...
Right. So it's probably worthwhile putting this in a bit of context. For the most part, you're probably not going to care too much about, most of your data structures in the system, in your application. You're probably going to care about a data structure that you use a lot of the time. So, you know, when we're talking about kind of where does that 1K or 2K of memory live and where does it live in the CPU cache, quite often you're not going to do that for every single data structure that you've built. So what you do is... you work out where, you know, what data structure is kind of most used in the system, and manipulated the most. And so obviously that's going to have the biggest impact if you get it right. So there's quite a few tools you can use to diagnose that and figure out what's going on. There's like even Visual Studio 2010, the performance profiler for that. It has a feature to determine what data structures are cache friendly versus not. And so you saw in the presentation, the example we gave is we fired up an application and profiled it using the classic sampling profile. And, you know, it gave us a result of two methods that are doing some stuff, but we didn't know which method. Like, we knew one was expensive and the other one wasn't, but we didn't know why.
But they looked about the same when you profiled.
They looked about the same when you profiled. So what we did was we changed the preferences of the sampling profiler, and instead of sampling on clock cycles, so every 1 million clock cycles, we changed that to sample on every 1 million cache miss, L2 cache miss. So it's an option in Visual Studio that not many people know about.
So you can, I hadn't seen it before, so yeah, it was
so you
like...
So you can literally say, I want to only sample the call stack every time there's a every millionth time there's a cache miss. You rerun the application, and it told us exactly where the method was
yep.
that was causing a lot of cache misses. So that's kind of what you need to do. You can run these profiling tools based on L2 cache miss, and then you're away. You've got the list of things you can go after.
So all these things are with performance, I suppose it's always a moving wall, right? So you go through things, you run your CPU sampling first, and you find out, well, everything looks kind of okay, so now let's take the next step, fix something else up, and then you go back and look at CPU cycles again, and then look at memory, and then look at CPU, and it kind of, it's this moving game.
Yep. So what I've found quite often is that if you want to speed up your app, you don't even need to kind of run this profiling stuff. Like, it's good to run it to get the measurements in place and so on, but you're going to get big wins just by taking the kind of top 10 guys that are showing up, and you just go and make them faster, and then all of a sudden your entire app gets much, much quicker. So there's like asymmetric payoff for just nailing the kind of top 10.
Fantastic. We like that. We only have to fix 10 things in an app. Perfect. Well, maybe.
Yeah, and you know... I kind of don't want to scare people here.
I do. I reckon it's great.
Yeah, at the end of the day, doing simple stuff like making your data structures smaller is going to give you big wins.
Yep.
And that's the core message.
Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the concurrency runtime. So you ran through some of that. So the concurrency runtime is going to be something not many people have heard of in the first place. And do you want to just give a quick overview of what that is and how it compares to Parallel Task Library and the things that turned up in .NET 4?
Yeah, well, I think it's a bit of a forerunner of those in a lot of respects. It actually comes from the robotics group, I think, at Microsoft, and it was part of a product called CCR DSS. I think it's coordination and concurrency runtime, and I don't know what the DSS bit is because I don't use that. but basically, it's a way of It's a way of sending messages or doing asynchronous programming by sending messages, and it's got some really useful ways of handling those messages and doing things like joins and selective receives on those messages.
So when you say messages, you're talking about not MSMQ type messages.
No, so these are...
This is like the Erlang mailbox kind of approach or something different?
You could definitely use it like a mailbox, yeah. So basically you have a port you can send a message to, and that's a .NET, you know, object. You post an object to a port mm-hmm. by making a function call, and then you've got some logic running on top of that port to do something with it, and you've got a lot of control over, you know, the underlying threads that's scheduled on and how it's scheduled, and you can do things like waiting on messages from multiple ports, doing a join and then processing them at once, those sorts of things. Joel, you probably want to add some more on that.
So I really liked CCR, but the reality is that it's in the robotics download. So yep. the robotics team own it, and I know there's guys on it that are moving that forward. There's a new one, like a new actor framework, which is kind of CCR is an actor framework, but there's a new actor framework that's coming out from the TPL team in Microsoft called TPL Dataflow. And if you look at it, it's pretty similar to CCR, but under the hood, it's using the task parallel library optimizations. So the TPL stuff in general is pretty well optimized. Like, it's got self-tuning, allocators and schedulers and so on. So DF, I think, is probably worth looking at.
That's available for download, or because
yep, so it's in beta or something.
So it's in the 4.5 runtime, or
it's not in the box. I think you need to download it. Yeah.
Okay. So it's definitely. Does it work with? So does it work with 4.0?
Yes.
Okay. So it works with 4.0. It'll work with 4.5, but it's not going to be necessarily. Well, we don't know yet. It might be baked in. It might not be.
Yeah. Who knows? Who knows?
Wait and see.
Yeah.
So how does that work then? So what an actor. Approach. Do you want to just explain the high level for those who are going, what the who is an actor? And
sure, yeah. So think about a normal class or component you implement. You're making multiple concurrent function calls on that. You've got to somehow deal with that concurrency, either external to the object by locking or internal to the object by doing some sort of locking or concurrency control. Actors take a different approach. They basically say there's only one way of communicating with this object or component. It's by sending it a message. That message is going to be processed asynchronously, possibly responded to by sending a response message back.
Mm-hmm.
And the messages themselves are immutable. So you get this nice property from a concurrency point of view that there's no shared mutable memory between actors.
Mm-hmm.
They're free to exchange these immutable messages. So if you're writing actor code, you're basically popping messages off your queue, processing them, then responding or doing whatever you need to do with them. And within the nice safe cocoon of the actor, you can write basically thread, unthread safe code, because you know that these messages are being processed sequentially. You don't have to worry about concurrent threads running in the context of your actor.
And so the messages will queue up as well?
Exactly. Yeah, messages will queue up.
So why is it called an actor or not a processor or something? Because it just seems like a weird term. Because actor, I'm immediately thinking, Hollywood and Angelina Jolie. And then I just get confused at that point. It's just, my brain blanks out for some reason.
Yeah, I'm pretty blank on that one too. I have no idea why they're called actors. It's got its roots in Erlang, and I expect there's some history there, but I'm not sure.
Okay. All right, so we take these messages, they just come through, they queue up, and if we get a big queue of messages, no big deal, unless obviously we kill the process.
Yeah, well, you've got to, from an application modeling point of view, you've got to understand what your constraints are, and if you've got a bottleneck in your system, actors don't necessarily solve that. From an efficiency point of view, it's a very interesting thing to think about queuing, because depending on how your actor is processing those messages, if you've got a big queue to get through, it could be more efficient or less efficient. So one thing that's interesting about TPL Dataflow is it'll spin up one task on the thread pool for an actor, and while there are messages still to drain, the same task will continue to drain them. So your overhead cost of dealing with the messages is amortized over all those messages. So there are some nice things about that model there, as opposed to, you could do a naive implementation that basically put every single one on the thread pool separately, which would incur the cost of doing that.
So so if you've got five messages, it won't spin up five separate threads.
Well, it'll process them sequentially. Now,
so it just spins up the one thread for that on actor effectively.
On TPL Dataflow, it'll process them all on the same thread pool thread in all likelihood. Yeah, there are some optimizations. I think the TPL Dataflow is still evolving. There are probably some optimizations there in some circumstances. Maybe, you know, to workload balance, it might do things differently. But certainly, I've seen a lot of throughput in that sort of pattern.
So how's that differ to the normal, I suppose, the async and await keywords that are turning up in C# 5 and the approaches that's taking? So that's basically saying we're not really doing actors, but we have a section of code and we're just doing callbacks and it's handling all that for us. So we could achieve almost the same sort of scale without having to deal with some of that complexity, right?
Yes. So the big difference is in is when you want to start to introduce more complexity into your asynchronous processing. That's the big difference. So I would say that await and so on is lower level in the stack. And when you start to think about composing those things together, that's when it gets complex. When you move up the stack, the idea is, like, the more abstract you get, the more opportunity you have to do, you know, more interesting things, I guess. So actors, and particularly CCR and TPLDF, have a really nice join calculus. So you can kind of spin up a bunch of actors, and kind of the first thing you want to do is when those results are available and ready to be consumed, you want to kind of join them together and process them depending on the outcome.
So like a MapReduce situation you're talking, or something a bit different?
Well, I mean, yeah, you could do actor-based MapReduce, but I guess what I'm saying is you've got a whole bunch of other things to consider, like error handling, and in general, how, like, what you want to do with the data that's been executed and produced. And so that join calculus is a good way to saying, hey, you guys have gone off and done a bunch of work, and when you're ready, you've let me know and you've sent me back a bunch of messages. So I'm going to look at all of those messages and then make decisions about what I want to do next. So that's how it kind of, it's really nice and composable. I'm trying to think if there's a good example. Maybe Patrick has one.
Yeah, you put me on the spot there. In terms of async await versus actors, I'd make one observation. I think actors is more of a system-wide organizing concept for how you would organize your system. Async await is as Joel said, it's sort of further down the stack. It's potentially a technology you could use to implement actors, but actors is something that you would really do system-wide.
Okay, so if we think actors is a strategic architectural decision, and yeah, async and await's your tactical, make this operation fast or this little section of code faster because of X, Y, and Z.
That could be it. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Cool, cool, cool. All right, so what are some of the other tips just in terms of performance and helping bump up the hot parts of the application?
Well, I think one of the keys is knowing what the hot parts are. So, well, it sounds obvious, but good measurement is really the key to all this stuff, I think. And I think you can really always measure better and measure more, and automating that measurement as much as possible, and being able to repeat measurement in a controlled way, controlling variables, is really, really important. And it's a struggle, to be honest. It's not easy at all. So just getting automation around that and being able to do it repeatably over the lifetime of a project, understand how you're meeting goals and understand where costs are within that.
Yep.
That's the key. Once you've got that, you can do something with it. I think oftentimes when you're starting out, there are really obvious low-hanging, you know, fruit that you almost don't need to measure to know that there are opportunities to optimize. But the faster and faster a system gets, the less obvious it becomes to the naked eye as to where performance improvements lurk. And so sort of the better you get, the more important the measurement becomes, and the more important having real benchmarks and measuring the thing you think you're measuring. We didn't really get to talk about it in the talk so much, but you know, running micro benchmarks on .NET, there's a lot of stuff you got to think about there.
Benchmark being
a very narrow test. So, you know, in contrast to say a system-wide test, where you know if your system processes messages, you pump in a bunch of messages and measure responses.
Yep.
A micro benchmark is, say, I'm calling a particular API in my system.
Yep.
I'm just running that in a process, calling it and measuring.
Yep.
So, understanding how you control variables there, like GC, JIT. You know, collection sizing,
mm-hmm.
thread pool sizing, those kind of things. So,
and that makes a difference also with the whether you compile any CPU and versus x86, I assume as well. In terms of numbers,
yeah. So it's always interesting for me to play around with that, and I must admit, I have a very poor record of predicting what's going to be faster in terms of which compilation mode. So yeah. Experimenting with all those things and measuring is really important.
Did you do anything to track performance in production at all? Because, you know, we can play around with these things while we're doing development, but we're kind of doing it on our own test rigs. And when an app gets to production, it's, you know, not always the same. So I know that Stack Overflow, for instance, they have some tools they run in production to see what performance is like at times. Did you do, and I suppose the volumes are different, and obviously, tracking things in production has a performance impact as well.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. Minimizing, being able to get information out of a system in production at a minimal cost is really important. Performance counters are extremely cheap. So you should always be writing custom performance counters for your app and installing them and monitoring them. Beyond that, I think Joel's got some great experience with doing really lightweight logging, which he might want to talk about.
Sure, yeah. So we were using ETW, event tracing for Windows, to do a lot of performance-based logging. And that's also extremely cheap.
How does that work? Because most people, if they do logging, they basically run log for net or nlog or just debug write line.
Yeah, so it's a tracing framework, but it's baked into the kind of the Win32 API at the kernel level. So you write a ETW.
So this means com interop.
Not really. So it's a p-invoke cost there somewhere, but in fact, if you do it properly, there's no p-invoke cost.
P-invoke's super cheap anyway.
Yeah, p-invoke is cheap. But, you know, for the most part, you kind of want to look at ETW as a way of doing tracing in your application. So the trace messages are, handled by the kernel. They're written out asynchronously. So to any listener that is available. So the other kind of point here is that an IT administrator can essentially turn off tracing on a server at any point.
Okay.
And the call to, hey, write this message to the ETW subsystem is a no-op. It costs you essentially nothing. And then when you have problems and you want to log out performance or any other issues, you just turn tracing on and you say log the ETW trace out to a file or a database or whatever. It's all system administration defined. And that file gets written. It's all written in kernel mode, not user mode. So it's really, really cheap. And then a developer basically takes that file and control the ETW tracing and, you know, derive what's going on. So it's really nice. Really, really nice. I'm surprised. And Windows does ETW all over the place. You can get all sorts of interesting stuff from Windows because it's constantly writing to the ETW trace.
This is what Watson uses, is it?
Or
it's a little bit different.
No, but a little bit different. But there's a tool called XPerf,
yep.
Which is an ETW log kind of trace listener crawler. And it will read and listen to these ETW events that are generated by Windows, and they're everything from kind of, I don't know, like switching, kernel-level switching to, like, oh, I mean, it's everything. Windows logs out everything. And so you can listen to that, and then it'll amalgamate the data and then graph it for you. So, like, disk.io and a bunch of other I.O. stuff
is
all logged out as well.
Nice.
And XPerf will give you a nice graph rendering for what's going on in your app. And you can use that for your app as well if you have your own ETW traces.
Cool.
That's pretty nice.
All right, guys, I think we're getting to about time. So any final plugs you want to throw to the listeners, say, you know, how awesome you are and all that sort of thing. Or it's self-evident.
Joel's awesome.
Patrick's awesome.
All right, you two, I'm going to let you get a room. You'll be fine. All right, so thanks for coming on the show, guys.
Thanks for having us. Really appreciate it.
No problem. And thanks for listening, everyone else. We will catch you on the next episode of Talking Shop Down Under. And until then, as always, happy coding.
See you later.
See you later.
Visit talkingshopdownunder.com for previous shows or to subscribe to the feed. Your feedback is always very much appreciated, so get in touch and let us know what you're thinking. Reviews can be left on iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace. Email can be sent to mail@talkingshopdownunder.com and tweets to @talking_shop. That's it for now. Show's over. Go home, people. Go home.